Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with Michael Berenbaum, acclaimed Holocaust survivor, scholar. Oh my goodness, we're off to a great start. Okay. I'm so nervous about having you here. When I say acclaimed, I mean extraordinarily acclaimed. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. On 10/7/2023, the Western world was shocked and horrified by the terror and brutality unleashed in the single largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. The parallels were undeniable and very widely discussed. The rapturous sadism with which the atrocities were executed, absolutely satanic. And the way that Hamas terrorists have taken over Gaza, so similar to Nazism and the rise of Hitler. And of course, the hostages, released in a perverse circus of depravity. The comparisons to survivors of the Nazi death camps were impossible to ignore. In sickly, ironic, and very deliberate narratives, pro-Hamas anti-Semites and anti-Zionists also rushed to comparisons. Gaza as a concentration camp, the IDF as the new Nazis, and Benjamin Netanyahu playing the role of Hitler. Today, Michael Berenbaum and I we'll discuss Hamas and the Holocaust, the similarities, the differences, and why we need to know the difference. If you don't know the connection between Hamas's Gaza and Nazi Germany, you owe it to yourself to listen to this conversation. Learn how very far the Islamic Nazi alliance goes back, how inextricably linked the ideologies really are, and the historical lessons that may just save Western civilization. Michael Berenbaum is one of the most internationally renowned Holocaust scholars alive today. He's the director of the Sigi Ziering Institute, exploring the ethical and religious implications of the Holocaust, and a distinguished professor of Jewish studies at the American Jewish University. The author and editor of 24 books. He was also the executive editor of the second edition of the Encyclopedia Judaica. Michael was project director overseeing the creation of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and the first director of its research institute. He later served as president and CEO of Steven Spielberg, Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation. And Michael has developed and curated museums across the globe, and his work in film has earned both Oscars and Emmys. A rabbi, professor, and lecturer, Berenbaum's work examines the intersection of historical trauma and contemporary culture. His scholarship has shaped both academic study and public understanding of the Holocaust, and he continues to be a leading voice in the field. Michael, it's quite a bio there.
Well, I mean, after such an introduction, I'm afraid to speak.
Well, and that's where this podcast ends. Thank you so much for coming, and I'll see you next time.
Okay, let's go.
For real. Thank you so much for coming. So we have so much to cover today. It sounds like we may not cover it all, so there may be a part two. But for right now, let's jump right into the deep end. Genocide. Where and when was this word coined, and what does it actually mean?
Let's begin with what the word is composed of. It's composed of two words, geno and side. Side is murder, and geno is from a genus, the murder of a group of people identified as a group of people. The word was coined, and it was meant to give you a chill. Was coined by a Polish Jewish refugee by the name of Rafael Lemkin. And he coined it as he was understanding what the Holocaust, the word didn't exist then, what the murder, systematic murder of the Jews, what the Germans called the final solution to the Jewish problem, what it shared with the Armenian genocide. And he came up with a definition of, he came up with a word which was supposed to be so horrific, the murder of a people, the elimination of an entire species of humanity, that the world would be frightened of it. He worked then later on to have it, he taught at Duke University, at Yale University, and then he went to work as a one-man lobbyist in the United Nations to seek to create the Convention on Genocide, which was passed by the United Nations in December of 1948. And there were two documents passed, one right after the other, by the United Nations at that point. One was the International Declaration of Human Rights, which is an aspirational document, what human rights should share, and in one sense, it's so aspirational that United States, that then had segregation, signed on to it, and the Soviet Union, even under Joseph Stalin, signed on to it. But the aspiration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then the International Convention on Genocide. And genocide was not an aspirational document, but a legal document. And the definition of genocide was the elimination of a people in whole or in part with the intent to destroy them. And the word intent is very important. And there's another word we have to pay attention to, in whole or in part. But by that, Raphael Lemkin intended to speak of the Armenian genocide, because Armenians were safe in certain areas of Turkey, precisely as they were being annihilated in other areas of Turkey. And the intention was not the final solution of the Armenian problem, the elimination of the Armenians everywhere. The intent was to destroy the Armenians, but not all Armenians, and not all Armenians everywhere. When it came to Hitler's final solution to the Jewish problem, which is the way in which they named, the Germans named it, and they named it accurately, because if the Jews are a problem, you want to solve it. And if the solution is the elimination of the Jews everywhere, it's a final solution to the Jewish problem.
And how does that tie in with ethnic cleansing?
Well, ethnic cleansing is essentially something that's been practiced. Genocide's been practiced many times in human history, but ethnic cleansing means that you eliminate people from a territory. That's different than eliminating people from the face of the earth.
Okay, so...
And in ethnic cleansing, you're essentially getting rid of a population from the area in which you dwell. By the way, none of this is designed... It means that we shouldn't oppose ethnic cleansing. It means that let's understand that there are various ways in which we articulate evil. And one of the evils is ethnic cleansing, but it's the elimination of a population. It can be containment, putting them on reservations. It can be expulsion. It can be many things. It doesn't have to be annihilation, what the Nazis called extermination. And by the way, not only the Nazis, but multiple perpetrators called extermination. But I only do that when I speak Nazi speak. because extermination is what we do to rodents,
right,
and cockroaches,
sure,
not to human beings. That's why I use the word annihilation.
Got it. So just in the square rectangle analogy, so all genocides would incorporate ethnic cleansing, but not all ethnic cleansing is a genocide.
That's correct.
Okay, terrific. Thank you for clarifying that. We will we'll focus on genocide because that is really the buzzword of the day, isn't it? So as you mentioned, the word genocide was a direct reference to when it was established, to the Nazis' unprecedented massacres and the atrocities executed upon the Jews during the Holocaust. So can you just sort of lay out, at least in broad terms, what made this specific set of war crimes a genocide?
Well, let's begin by saying that the trial of Nuremberg in 1945-46 was a trial of war crimes. The word genocide was only used once. It was used not in the Nuremberg trials, but in the subsequent trials. A man who recently died at the age of 102, Ben Ferenz, used it in a trial of the Einsatzgruppen. And the Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killers who went from town to town, village to village, hamlet to hamlet, and directly slaughtered Jews by murdering them by bullets, bullet by bullet, town by town, village by village, men, women, and children. We now call that the Holocaust by bullets. Ben Ferenz was a 27-year-old prosecutor, had been a teaching assistant of a professor at Harvard, and became an expert in human rights, spoke German fluently, and came one day to, was going through documents, and looked at the documents and came across and realized that he had the documents in his hands of men, and I'm being gender specific, so I'm not not discriminating against women, of men, because were male killers, who had murdered in excess of 2 million people. And he went to Telford Taylor, who was then the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, said, "We have to bring these men to trial." Telford Taylor said, "We can't spare anybody." And he said, "But we must." He said, "Well, if you want to do that in addition to all your other assignments, go right ahead." And a young 27-year-old man, with difficulty standing 5 feet tall, maybe even 4'11", brought in, and he brought them to trial in 2 days. The entire prosecution was 2 days. He asked one very basic question. Is this your signature on this document? Would you read the document to the court?
Right.
And then they began to tally the number of people killed. And these were the Einsatzgruppen reports, the reports of the murder of towns, villages, and hamlets. So, for example, September 27th, 1941, we have executed 33,771 Jews in a town called Kiev. Signature. Your signature, yes. So these are your words, yes. And that's how he brought all of these different Einsatzgruppen people to trial. And we should understand that the officers of these were some enormously accomplished men. One, Otto Ollendorf, had a PhD in economics.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers, even some of them were ministers, and they were mobile killers who executed them. So he's the first one who used the word genocide to refer to what they were doing, which was systematic murder.
But genocide goes beyond the murder and beyond the intent.
Well, genocide goes to genocide goes to create conditions in which these people cannot survive. It goes to another thing which the Germans did. The Nazis did not against Jews as much as against Poles, which is the forceful kidnapping of children and raising them in a different culture. This is being practiced today
in Ukraine,
by Russia,
and Russia.
By Russia,
absolutely.
Taking Ukrainian children. But if we look throughout history, there has been the attempt at acculturation. There's a beautiful Renaissance city in Poland between Lublin and Lviv and Lublin called Zamość. What they did there was the Nazis came in and they took high IQ'd, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Polish kids. They removed them from their parents and they had them adopted by Germans in Nazi Germany and brought up as their children. And if you think of it, it's almost more cruel to at least the parents than murdering the child, because if you're a parent and your child is kidnapped, there's no place to ever come to terms with that, because you think Every knock on the door may be your child returning home. Every time for the rest of your life that you see somebody who may look like your kid,
right,
who is of the age of your child, even in his 30s and 40s, you think, right, maybe that is my child. So right, it's got a cruelty. And what?
And that your child is being raised by the enemy.
Being raised.
So I've thought about this, and so have a lot of people, vis-a-vis, God bless their memory, the Bebas boys. A lot of people brought up, what if the thought of what if they were brought up to be Palestinian children and to be Hamas or to be suicide bombers in Israel? I mean, how heartbreaking would that have made the Bebas story that much more intense?
The Bebas story, horrific, despicable, impossible. That might have made it worse. It was horrific enough without that. But genocide, and again, the idea behind genocide in its legal definition is intent.
Right.
And this is important because some of the documents, for example, document from Amnesty International says we can't establish intent. But if you can't establish intent, then you can use many words. The word you can't use, which has a legal systematic definition, is genocide. And the other thing, let's be very specific. Those who are accusing Israel of genocide have a demographic problem. Demographic problem is that there are approximately 7 million Jews living between the river and the sea, and 5 million Palestinians.
Wait, what river? What sea?
Between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River.
And what does that refer to? What does that piece of land refer to?
That refers to the land that was until 1948 Palestine. After 1948, it was divided between Israel. The state of Israel was established and was divided between Israel, and then it was a territory of Jordan, occupied territory of Jordan. In 1967, it became territory occupied by Israel. So between the river and the sea is now Israeli territory, sovereign territory, the state of Israel, and certain areas behind what we call the Green Line, and then occupied legally, if we speak legally, occupied by Israel in terms of that. And Gaza is not occupied by Israel, has not been occupied by Israel for since 2005, so 20 years now, but it, from 2007 onward, was under the control of Hamas.
So in layman's terms, just so people understand, the river to sea means Israel. It's what it actually means.
No, the river to sea in layman's terms, that we could look, I'm painting the posterior.
Yeah, you are painting the posterior.
So the river and the sea would encompass what Jews might call the historic land of Israel,
mm-hmm,
what Israel would legally call Israel, and the occupied territory, what Palestinians would call Palestine. It's disputed. Mm-hmm. Some of this is disputed territory. And the Palestinians recognized Israel in 1993 as part of the Oslo Accords. So we'd have to say it encompasses Israel, occupied territories legally, territories which Palestinians claim are Palestinian territories, which some Jews claim are the historic land. All Jews
okay,
know.
Okay, this is a rabbit hole.
You deal with me, you got to deal with precision. Let me go back to the major point, which is that if Israel were committing genocide, then why is it the Palestinian population has increased and increased and increased? We don't have that in any other genocidal situation.
Of course.
And the other thing is that no one could establish the intent to eliminate. Israel has said it's at war with Hamas.
Sure.
It's not at war with the Palestinian people.
Well, I mean, honestly, since the determination of genocide really does depend on intent, and people just keep, I don't know if overlooking is the word, purposely ignoring this word, because I can't say that world leaders and NGOs and the UN don't understand the concept of intent, but can IDF operations in Gaza, considering the fact that there are stringent civilian casualty mitigation rules in place, that Israel has literally accommodated aid to the Strip, water, electricity, not to mention vaccinated 95% of their population, the Gazan population, for polio.
Of the children, yeah.
So, well, that's who gets no, vaccinated.
I'm painting that because I'm so precise.
My question is like considering the bar of intent, if there were intent to commit genocide, none of these things would have existed.
Well, we can say, let me say it very simply. Israel has the capacity to commit genocide, meaning it has overwhelming force. It has a interest in committing genocide because the territories that it would conquer and the population that it would eliminate were populations that had been sending rockets toward Israel and attacking its population. It has responded to an attack. There was a ceasefire on October 6, 2023. The ceasefire was violated, and everybody knows that the fundamental element of a just war is self-defense. Hamas attacked, murdered 1,200 Jews, took 1,200 people, most of them Jews. Some of them were Arabs, some of them were Muslims, some of them were Thai citizens of Thailand and the like. Took 250 people captive, most of them Jews, but not all, some Muslims, some Thai, etc. And the question becomes, the definition of a just war is to respond to an attack from another territory. We consider Mexico having, quotation marks, invaded the United States. Imagine what would happen if they were sending rockets and made people from Arizona, Texas, and California live, evacuate the border and live in exile from their homes. Having said that, Israel fought a just war by every standard definition of what a just war is. The real question is, how do you fight a just war when the opposition uses human beings of its own population as human shields, and when it commits what we define as war crimes, meaning keeping arms in hospitals, in schools, in mosques, and using non-military population as human shields against it? So the question that we have, and which will be answered for the next half generation, is how do you fight a just war under those circumstances? Now, Israel, let's talk about the accusations of genocide in a particular way. Israel has given warnings of what territory, of what areas it's going to attack. I don't know of that in other instances of genocide.
Sure.
Israel has provided aid, and the question becomes, providing aid is even within the territories of the Gaza Strip. Question is whether the aid is confiscated by Hamas, then resold to the population in order to finance it, and whether the aid actually reaches its population. Israel has continued to treat in its own hospitals some of the most critically ill people. So whatever you want to say about what Israel's doing, that's not the condition of genocide. And we even had something in the last couple of weeks come out, which is that 70% of the Hamas Ministry of Health, the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health, since Hamas controls both the Gaza Strip militarily and the Gaza Strip in terms of its own forces, Hamas's own health ministry, which has also been an instrument of propaganda, has just said that essentially 70% of the people who were killed were men between the ages of 13 and 55, which is by definition those who could be military age and military participation for Hamas. So it's refashioned the figures.
Of course.
And we're going to have a debate over this as information becomes more clear, as information becomes more detailed. It's refashioned the notion that it's women and children, and Israel has always claimed that it is going after fighters, and Hamas has always indicated in its figures that it's not dealing, differentiating between military and non-military casualties. All this is not to say that the civilian population of Gaza has not suffered. It suffered greatly. All this is not to say that there have not been the decimation of its homes, etc., etc. But that occurred in the context of responding to an attack, and in the context of which all of the territory and much of the areas that are involved sequesters military equipment in the basic institutions that by international law should be protected.
Sure. Well, I mean, devastation can't be a measure of genocide, because by that measure, every single war would be a genocide. And because every war takes place within a particular country, basically every casualty is going to be a citizen of that country. So by that definition, every war is also ethnic cleansing. So it's ridiculous, these notions that just because there's been devastation in a just war. And it almost begs the question to me, Michael, everything that you just said is, so Hamas is using human shields. Hamas is hiding underneath its civilian population. Hamas is taking the aid. Hamas is doing all these things. Is there any way, because the intent is fairly obvious, because among other things, they've said it out loud. They want to see their civilians killed because it helps their cause. It helps to get sympathy for their cause.
Let's be restrained. They are willing to have their civilians killed as what they would call casualties in order to achieve a military goal. In other words, most armies and most military operations try to protect civilians, women and children and the elderly, and regard that as not collateral damage, but as basic loss that they have to protect against. Hamas is willing to consider them collateral damage, and that's why in the last couple of weeks we've had some demonstrations of Palestinians against Hamas, and part of that is because Hamas fighters have been relegated to tunnels, and therefore the civilian population can have an expression of its own. But again, devastation, there is a plenty, but devastation is not genocide, it is devastation. Devastation is terrible, horrible, miserable, but it's also not genocide.
Absolutely, that was one of my points, but the other point is, and I know, I have no idea what the answer to this is, is there a construction of the concept of genocide that might actually implicate Hamas in the genocide of its own people using them as human sacrifices?
Well, we can say the following, that the original charter of Hamas was genocidal against the Jews. It called for the elimination of the Jews. Unabashedly, unapologetically, directly genocidal. There was an amendment to that original founding document, which then spoke of Zionists and Israelis, and we'll talk about the differences, et cetera, et cetera, not speaking of it, the Jews. And the murder that they decimated, the reason that they killed the civilians was an intent to destroy a people. And had they succeeded to go further, they might have gone further. And the irony is that the people they murdered in Israel, most especially along the border, are precisely the left and the peace-seeking left in Israel that had been working against its government in trying to establish fine relations with their quotation marks neighbors. So those were the populations that were decimated.
So seeing as the intent of the 10/7 massacres was literally to kill as many Jews as possible, that was the intent. Is that a genocide according to the Genocide Convention?
The problem with saying yes or no is the question in part, and that is how large a part. If I murder you because you're Jewish, I'm murdering a person because in part. Now, the context for the definition in part was the Armenian genocide, in which in excess of 1 million people were murdered, but not the entire population. So the question is, we can call it a murder, a massacre, a destruction, an attack, an unwarranted attack, an aggressive attack, a sadistic attack, a violent attack, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need to use the G word in order to condemn it. Mm-hmm. It's sufficient to condemn it for what it was. Let me say that the other word people then try to use is the H word. The G word is the genocide word. The H word is the Holocaust. Now, I've spent a career trying to tell people that there is nothing equivalent to the Holocaust, but that doesn't mean that things can't be compared to the Holocaust. But when you and I were in high school, if we can dare to remember back to those terrible days, when you and I were in high school, we always had an essay question which said compare and contrast.
Right.
What comparison means is that there are certain things it shares in common and certain things differentiate it. I tell my Jewish compatriots that this is not the Holocaust, which doesn't mean that it's good or not horrible, terrible, miserable, and all of that. But the Holocaust was a systematic state-sponsored murder of the Jews that occurred over 12 years in 24 countries and involved the mechanism of the most powerful country and the most powerful culture in Western civilization at that point, and took all the efforts of the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union in order to bring it to a halt. Let me also say that if Israel were committing genocide, it would have never sought a ceasefire, because I know of no other instance of genocide, and I've studied genocide my entire professional life. I was in Rwanda shortly after the genocide to consult with the government on how to document the nature of the crime. If Israel was committing genocide, it would not have asked for a ceasefire, would not have agreed to a ceasefire, because there is no other instance of genocide in which a ceasefire was agreed to by the dominant, powerful entity in the battle. So it is not the equivalent of the Holocaust, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have elements that can be compared to it and contrasted with it, which is the way in which we have to understand it. If you're not polemical, but if you're really dealing with the history that's involved.
Yeah. So why are sweeping analogies so important to avoid? Why is it so important to be like, yes, what's going on is that, and let's say it was determined that whatever, there's ethnic cleansing or whatever, why would it be important not to say this is the Holocaust all over again?
The reason is, number one, it diminishes the importance of the Holocaust. It diminishes the horrific element of the word and the crime genocide. And the other is, very simply, if you perceive it through that lens, you're misperceiving it. So therefore, Jews who think this is the Holocaust Redux are misunderstanding what the human what the current situation is. Those Jews were powerless. We Jews have a modicum of power that is radically different. We have alternatives. We have possibilities. In the end, they faced ultimately something we call choiceless choices. Number one, the perpetrator of Nazi Germany ultimately controlled virtually the entire continent of Europe, well into the Soviet Union, with the exception of Great Britain. And a couple of neutral countries, self-described neutral countries. If you know the history, neutrality was not necessarily quite neutral. Right. But having said that, and it was an advanced culture with all sorts of elements involved, which is why the Holocaust implicates the totality of Western civilization, because Germany had the best art, the best music, the best literature, the greatest philosophy. The crime was perpetrated by some of the, what we call in my Vietnam parlance, the best and the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
8 of the 15 men who sat at the Wannsee conference, and again, I'm gender specific here, 8 of the 15 men had doctorates. The doctors who participated were doctors who had MD, PhDs, the elite of the elite.
Sounds familiar.
The elite of the elite who were participating in this. So that's why it has a very different implication and a very different impact. So I try to, and there's also a cliche that has truth to it. Those who fight the last, who refight the last war, lose the next one. In other words, history doesn't quite repeat itself, but we have to face the different realities that we have in a very basic way.
So I have a follow-up question on a lot of what you just said regarding what would qualify as a genocide. The way that you framed it seemed to imply that size and scale was relevant, but I've never seen that mentioned in the current definition of genocide. I'm wondering, has the definition of genocide somehow evolved since it was created?
The use of the word genocide, the use and misuse of the word genocide has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of genocide, look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm married to a lawyer, but I'm not a lawyer.
So you're half a lawyer.
She's my much better half, but I wouldn't say I'm a half a lawyer. Having said that, there is a legal definition that is codified.
Yeah.
That was ratified by multiple nations on the face of the earth. If you're changing that, then you want to change that legally. People, and we see how people are misusing the word genocide in all sorts of ways. So I wouldn't say it's evolved. I might even say it's devolved. Sure. Now, again...
Well, the definition hasn't. It's the way that people are interpreting it or failing to acknowledge it.
It's the way in which people are interpreting. It's also the weaponization of the word. We call that, years ago in my field, we had something called Holocaust denial. Denial was Nazis didn't murder the Jews. It was an innocent, he didn't know about it, et cetera, et cetera. That had a major defeat in the year 2000 when the most informed of all the pseudo-scholars who dealt with it was shown to be a racist who misused evidence all the way through. That's the Irving B. Lipstadt trial. So we've been working with Holocaust minimization, trivialization, vulgarization, satirization, And now we have a new term which we're using, which is called Holocaust inversion, which is all of a sudden speaking of what the Israelis are doing as a Holocaust.
Right.
Speaking of the Jews as the perpetrators instead of the victims and all of that, that's an inversion.
Right.
So one doesn't even have to be a supporter of the policies of the government of Israel to say that's not happening. Something else is.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are many things, ways to discuss it. But if you're trying to understand things clearly, carefully, meticulously, because you want to ultimately diffuse the situation and bring it to some sort of settlement, then if you're accusing one side of genocide, you're going in a way that doesn't allow it to come to some sort of conclusion.
So when it comes to this inversion, though, it seems to me that there's a much more nefarious strategy behind using the words that are so heavily loaded, right? To use the word genocide, to use the words ethnic cleansing, specifically in referring to the Jews. This isn't random.
It's a look. It's a propaganda campaign, and it's a well-financed, well-organized propaganda campaign.
But why these words?
Well, if I were an opponent of the state of Israel and I wanted to get up the ire of the Israelis, most especially the ire of the government of Israel in its current iteration, this is one of the ways in which I would do it. It makes perfect sense from the other side to use it. It doesn't, even though it makes perfect sense as a tool, it makes no sense as an accusation.
But it's also, there are implications that are so painful to place on the Jewish people who were the subjects of the most devastating genocide.
It then goes into blood libel. All Jews must be shedding blood. They're all guilty of wanton slaughter of innocents. It goes into the question of dual loyalty. I'm an American Jew. The presumption on some campuses was that an American Jew who supports the right of Jewish self-determination in Israel made me a Zionist and therefore implicated me in the quotation marks genocide that was taking place. It gives license to anti-Semitism. It gives license to blame. It reiterates all sorts of anti-Semitic tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And we should probably say, let's go back and if we talk about that, let's say, what is the difference between anti-Semitism and legitimate criticism of the state of Israel? And Israel is a human entity. Every government is worthy of criticism. And some of the greatest things you can do to countries you love and things you're committed to, and even people you love and people you're committed to, is to criticize them.
Sure.
But one guy said it very nicely. He said, let's criticize people like a mother, not like a mother-in-law.
Yes.
In other words, we're...
You don't have to explain that. Okay. I think everybody gets that.
I think that's... That's it. I had a mother who was fully capable of criticizing me, and more often than I would admit it, she was right.
Oh no!
But having said that, what is the difference? One of the clearest articulations of that is what we call the three Ds: double standards, delegitimation, demonization. If you judge Israel by one standard and the rest of the world by another standard, then you're bordering on, you're coming close to, you're flirting with, you're engaging in anti-Semitism. If you then say Israel, because it's done A, B, and C, has no right to exist, that's delegitimation. If Israel, for example, displaced a native population, Well, that's true of the United States, it's true of Canada, it's true of New Zealand, it's true of Mexico, it's true of Australia, it's true of 27 countries in the world, and it's probably true of virtually everybody. Every country in the world has displaced native populations, depending on how far you go back. So if Israel has no right to exist, then say the same thing about the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, sure. Mexico, etc., etc. And the third is the worst, which is Israel is demonic. It's not just wrong, it's not just mistaken, it doesn't merely have a bad government, but it's the source of evil in that sense. That's the moment in which you're engaging and re-engaging in anti-Semitism. Now, let's also talk about what is Zionism. Zionism essentially is, and there are multiple forms of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple forms, but the most basic element of Zionism is the belief that the Jews are a people, a nation, who have the right to self-determination. And what is a people? A people are include a language, a culture, a sociology, a food, a dance, a music, a tradition, and Jews are a religious civilization, to use the words of the great 20th century Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan. So if Jews are a nation, a people, they have a right to self-determination. And Zionism said we Jews have the right to self-determination. Now, one of the things that people don't understand is that a plurality of Jews now live in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really say you're anti-Zionist in one sense, you are saying I am opposed to the direction that the Jewish people have chosen for their own future, and opposed to the Jewish future because it will soon become, or may soon become, a majority of the Jewish people.
Sure.
And consequently, that's the future that they have chosen for themselves. And if you're anti-Zionist in the most basic sense of the term, then you are opposing the dimension, the direction in which Jews have chosen for themselves as to their future. That's why we, again, at that moment say, if you oppose our future, what are you giving us? What are you leaving us? And the like. And that's one of the reasons that you sense the movement between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism.
Sure.
Now, if you're anti all nationalism, then you're anti every country in the world, and at least the position has the virtue of being consistent.
So not to
consistently wrong.
So not to mitigate Natan Sharansky's theory, which obviously encompasses so much. I'd like to stack on it to say that another element that we're seeing now, because the jumping off point of this was, you said, where does legitimate criticism of the state of Israel go into anti-Semitism? So what I'm going to stack on top of these three D's is also the false equivalence of Jews with Israel. So the fact that a kid at UCLA, regardless of whether he's ever been to Israel, whether he's a religious Jew, because he's a Jew, cannot get to his sociology class or math class on the quad.
That's pure anti-Semitism.
But they cloak it. They say it's anti-Zionist.
They cloak it. It's also accusing Jews of having dual loyalty. It's accusing all Jews of being implicated for the deeds of. Of some Jews, it's venom, and consequently it should be opposed, and it's a violation of basic elements of what a university is supposed to be about.
Absolutely. Okay, so we're quickly running out of time. I got like five questions. So let me touch upon another concept while I have you, and again, hopefully we'll be able to continue this conversation another day. Let's talk about, again, drawing the parallels that keep coming out between the Holocaust and Gaza, this concept of an open-air prison or comparing Gaza to a concentration camp. The irony is not lost that So many of the gossip social media influencers built their whole name by showing like the extravagances that exist in Gaza, in saying that, oh, look what Israel did to destroy Gaza. So therefore, if Gaza were an open air prison, if Gaza were a concentration camp, irrespective of the fact that Israel completely disengaged and left in 2005, and the fact that they, of course, share a border with Egypt, to say that Israel has created a concentration camp, it's so ridiculous, but can you talk about what is the difference between a Holocaust concentration camp and the Gaza Strip?
Look, Gaza, I disagree with President Trump's notion of getting rid of all the Palestinians who are in Gaza and creating a beautiful French Riviera out of it. But Gaza has the capacity to be a very beautiful, very wonderful place. There were mansions in Gaza.
Right.
There were penthouses in Gaza. There's a beautiful beach. There's a lovely possibility. When Israel withdrew in 2005 completely from Gaza and dismantled its settlements, it essentially was offering the Palestinians a blueprint to a Palestinian state. And the blueprint to the Palestinian state is, here you have this territory, and if you want to live at peace with us, then you will develop this territory. One of the first things that was done was, and in fact, a man by the name of James Wolfenson of the World Bank had raised the funds to preserve the hothouses.
Right.
That were a source of enormous revenue for the Gazans. One of the first things that happened when Israel withdrew is they burnt down the hothouses because they had been left by Israelis, which is to burn down the economic infrastructure of a potential state. Once Hamas took over and it became a source of military attack, then even the Israelis who wanted a two-state solution, a Palestinian state, could not express their desire for a Palestinian state, even though if they regarded that as a just solution, because a Palestinian state represented people are going to attack us with what? With rockets. Imagine if we had attacks from Mexico. Imagine if we had attacks from Canada. Our president considers we have an invasion from Mexico, and they're shipping in all of this. Imagine how we would have responded as Americans if they were sending rockets to Fort Worth and to Dallas and to San Antonio and to Tucson and to San Diego and the like, and forcing those places to evacuate because we could not protect our citizens. What do you think our response would be as Americans to something like that? That's what happened from Gaza. So there was a forfeiting of an opportunity to create the impetus, the future impetus for a just relationship between independent Palestinian state and the state of Israel. And that's why the civilian population of Israel, the citizens of Israel, have moved to a place where they don't want to hear of a two-state solution, and they don't want to hear of empowering the Palestinians because they don't trust them. And not that, by the way, not that there's any great love between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but that's what makes it seemingly an insoluble situation.
Sure, but is Gaza a concentration camp or
not? No, it's clearly not. It's clearly not a concentration camp. Number one.
What is a concentration camp?
Let's begin. People are not accusing Gaza of quite being a concentration camp.
Oh, yes, they are on social media. They're thinking
of it as a ghetto. And a ghetto was an isolated area in which Jews were contained. Ghettos in Poland operated between 1940 and 1942, and in 1943, and in one case, 1944. They were a way to contain the Jews until. Now, nobody in 1940 knew what until was. In retrospect, the ghettos were a way to isolate, segregate, separate, and contain the Jews until a decision was made what to do with them and the apparatus was built for their annihilation. So by 42, the death camps came on board. By 43, virtually all the ghettos were destroyed, with the exception of the ghetto of Lodz in German-occupied Poland. So a concentration camp was essentially a prison. And a concentration camp had people within the prison. It had detainment, arbitrary arrest. It worked the people virtually to death. Israel has not even occupied these territories as much as attacked these territories. We may be moving right now into a situation where Israel occupies it because it didn't want to become an occupation force. Mm-hmm. Out of self-interest, because it felt the population was hostile enough that it would face the same types of things that occupying forces face, which is attacks and not the murder of hundreds of soldiers, but the murder of many soldiers over a period of time and a war of attrition. So they avoided occupation. They've been looking for a way. And on this, Prime Minister Netanyahu has not been very, has been deliberately non-clear as to what the day after is.
Yeah.
He's tried to, and the reason he's not been clear about the day after is because his own political coalition would fall apart with regard to the day after. But the question becomes, what do you do when you've eliminated Hamas as a military force capable of attack, but if you have not yet eliminated them as a force of government, who takes their place, and then who patrols, who contains, and who deals with it? And those accusing Israel of making Gaza into a concentration camp, a ghetto, forget one other factor, which is that there's a second border.
That's what I said, on Egypt could just as easily open that.
Second border is Egypt, and Egypt does not want Hamas in its country because Hamas is allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood is antithetical to the current government of Egypt, and consequently, Egypt has been essentially containing Gaza precisely in the same way that the Israelis have been containing Gaza, with the one exception that there is enough corruption around Egypt that arms have been smuggled in.
Massive amounts. And that
massive amounts of arms have been smuggled in into the territories, which has allowed Hamas to continue as a military force.
Sure. If anyone is keeping the Gazans imprisoned, it actually is Hamas. And the reason why there are blockades by Israel and, yes, by Egypt is not to subjugate the people, but to keep the terrorist elements out of Gaza, and so that they're not threatening neither Israel nor Egypt.
Israel essentially wanted, under Ariel Sharon, who was regarded as a right-wing prime minister, Israel wanted to get out of Gaza and give Gaza the opportunity to govern itself peacefully. And Israel has tried to restrict the material coming into Gaza so that it could not be used to create weapons and tunnels and the like. And it had every reason to do so. And part of, there's the push and pull involved in that. And there are those who would like to starve the Gazans, but they have not been dictating, up until now, they have not been dictating government policy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a whole nother problem, because in this maximum pressure campaign we've already established, Hamas is more than happy to sacrifice their own people for this cause, and Hamas happens to have sufficient aid to survive for a really long time.
For a significant time. How long, we don't know, and we have to see what's involved in that. But Hamas has been seriously reduced as a military factor, but its ability to cause damage and create havoc has not been reduced. And You know, let's go back to a very basic thing. Albert Einstein once said, what's the definition of insanity? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. Anybody looking at what Hamas did on October 7th would know that Israel would have to respond to that. Most intriguing thing is that the anti-Israel protests began on October 8th, well before, almost 2 weeks before, Israel began to respond to what happened in Gaza. And it was thoroughly foreseeable that the consequences of what they were doing would lead to devastation in Gaza, and Hamas was perfectly comfortable with that type of devastation to its own population. So they have made the Palestinian people in Gaza far more vulnerable, and that's one of the reasons you had the recent protests taking place, and we'll see what happens. My assumption is that you will see some leaders of the protest murdered and assassinated and all of that as a way of asserting Hamas's dictatorial control.
We already have. So it's been 1 hour. I know how do you want to be late for your next thing?
Let's do it again.
Okay, we'll do it again because I have 10,000 pages left of questions. And, okay. And thank you so much. This has been a great jumping off point. And until next time. Now I get super pro when I walk across the room to turn this off. Thank you.